Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies, and a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. This is the first episode for 2024. I'm getting over some weird sort of flu that kind of ravaged our household over Christmas, and then we gave it to my parents and my grandmother and my uncle, and everybody we seem to encounter picked it up from us, so that was fun. I'm still kind of getting over it. My voice is a little raspy, and I'm still, you know, not feeling 100%, but I'm getting better. And today I have, this has been a long time in the making, and we've been trying to schedule something for a while, and it hasn't worked for various reasons, but now we're doing it. So we're doing it now. So I have here, if you know him from Twitter, it's Donald Jacob Uitvlucht, and that last name is Uitvlucht, and we had to go through how to pronounce that before we started recording. You might know him from Twitter and other places, and he is a fiction writer, and he wrote a book we're going to be discussing today, and kind of a whole genre of storytelling from the East, so from Asia. So stuff I don't know a whole lot about, so hopefully Donald can enlighten us. And Donald, why don't you introduce yourself, who you are, you know, what your background is, anything you want to provide.
My name is Donald. I'm a husband and a father, a Catholic Christian, and all my life I've enjoyed stories, have been a voracious reader all my life, and at some point discovered that in addition to reading stories, if I wanted to read some of the sort of stories I wanted to, I needed to write stories too. And so I've been writing off and on since about sixth grade, but a little more seriously starting about 2007, focusing mostly on short stories. The first volume of Jiaotu's Endeavor is my first completed novel.
Gotcha. Yeah, and that's the book we're going to be discussing today, is Jiaotu's Endeavor. And I think you have a whole series planned, right, for this this character?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because episode one is The Kidnapped Mouseling. So that's... And why don't you give us a background of this series? The subtitle is called A Furry Sci-Fi Adventure. Why don't you explain what that is and give us some background on this?
Furry is kind of a controversial term. When I use it, I mean primarily having characters who are anthropomorphic animals, which is a very old tradition in literature, going back to beast myths and various kind of early cultures, the animals in Aesop's fables. You have medieval examples in the Reynard Fox tales. And so I've always liked animal stories. Probably one of the books I've read most repeatedly growing up, which was Rudyard Kipling's Just So Stories, which have a lot of animal characters. And I decided when I thought about writing a novel that if I were going to write my novel, I was going to throw in as many things as I liked into the mix as I could. And so beast men characters, it's also a science fiction story, but the setting of the story is on a world where most of the characters don't realize they're in a science fiction story. So a lot of it comes across as more fantasy adventure than kind of your spaceships and lasers, pew-pew sort of sci-fi.
Right, right. Which is a pretty, you know, which is a pretty interesting sort of setting for your story. And at the beginning of the book, you have a quote, and it's kind of like an ad. It says, "For immediate international release, the Endeavor Corporation is recruiting brave and talented individuals to embark on an adventure the likes of which the world has never known. An unprecedented Sino-Indian corporation, a cooperation, and subsequent advances in low-gravity construction techniques have resulted in the manufacture of the Endeavor. Built in our shipyards at the L5 station, this state-of-the-art interstellar colony ship is engineered on the McKendry cylinder model and constructed from materials mined from the asteroids. Named after the HMS Endeavor, the ship that brought Captain James Cook to the new lands of the Pacific Ocean, our Endeavor promises to bear the hopes and aspirations of the best of humanity to a new home out among the stars. Are you ready to be one of the chosen few?" And it goes on, but it's basically, it takes place on a ship.
The basic startup premise of the world is about 200 years in our future. I think somewhere in my world building, I put a date of 2273. Mm-hmm. There is a corporation which represents a cooperation from various Chinese companies and various Indian companies. They engage in this colonization project. Mm-hmm. So faster than light travel doesn't exist in this universe, and so they design generation ships, which are, they're kind of built in three major components. There's the propulsion system kind of at the base of the ship. There is the navigation section that also contains human beings in cryogenic suspended animation. And then the idea is these ships are being sent out to find Earth-like worlds that can be colonized, but you want to have a kind of Earth-based ecosystem that can be plugged right into these potential colony worlds. And so a long section of the ship, and we're talking about 3,000 kilometers or so, has vegetation, base life forms, and then also it's crewed by these anthropomorphic animals.
Right.
The idea being in this future world, genetic engineering has advanced to the point where there's a servitor class of uplifted animals that have been tasked with kind of keeping the biological systems of these generation ships running until they can find a habitable planet to colonize. But the thing is, these servitors don't know, by and large, that they're on a ship. The point where Jiao Tu's Endeavor picks up, we're at least 500 years into this mission, and the people who live inside this biosphere habitat think that this inside of the ship is the whole world. It's the only world they've ever known. And so various cultures and subcultures and communities have grown up in these 500 plus years.
Yeah, you have all... Oh, my gosh. I'm trying not to cough, but it's really hard. You have a whole, like, you set up a whole, like, civilization in there. There's different factions. And you do have humans. I mean, there's none in the story, but they are mentioned. They're all in cryogenic sleep. And these animals that have been augmented and uplifted to be, you know, sentient and have their own cultures and everything. They're kind of in charge of running the ship.
Yes.
You have different factions like engineering, and they obviously run the engines and stuff like that, and reclamations, and that's like the garbage, you know, the collectors, the garbage collectors, and the people who deal with all the refuse and the corpses and all that stuff. Yeah, it's very interesting. And then, who would be your main influences? This is very reminiscent of like Gene Wolfe. And you have the foreword to your book mentions your love of Borges, and then Stan Sakai's Usagi Yojimbo. And I remember that being, I remember as a kid seeing that in like comic book stores. So he's the rabbit samurai, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So that is very like, and that's the main character is Xiao Tu. He's also a rabbit, lagomorph, samurai. So what are all these influences, and how do you kind of incorporate them into your stories?
Well, like I had hinted at earlier, once I decided I was actually going to write a novel, I threw a lot of things that, A, I love into the mix, but also there are a lot of things I had been reading at the time. So around the time I was brainstorming the idea of this story, I'd been reading a lot of the manga and light novels, Vampire Hunter D. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain amount of the main character D from Vampire Hunter D that went into Xiao Tu's mix. I had been reading some of The Witcher short stories, and so there is some of Geralt of Rivia, especially him being a wandering swordsman who's also a monster hunter.
Yeah.
I've always loved sword and planet adventures, and so there is a certain amount of the classic sword and planet heroes like John Carter of Mars and Lee Brackett's John Eric Stark that are kind of in the mix of going into Xiao Tu's character. There's a strong amount of Usagi Yojimbo in Xiao Tu's character, mm-hmm. and Sakai has also made a series, I don't know if it's as well known, but it was a spin-off series that's been collected in a trade paperback about one of the original Usagi's great, 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 however many great grandsons, which is actually written as a kind of space opera. It's called Space Usagi.
Yeah.
And so Space Usagi is in the background. I knew I didn't want to be a direct clone, though. And so instead of drawing directly on Japanese culture, I wanted to differentiate Xiao Tu and maybe make it more of a Chinese inspired than Japanese inspired. And so there's certain elements, at least, that I'm drawing from Japanese anime and manga that are set in a fantasy China,
mm-hmm.
Of what limited knowledge I have of the wuxia genre and its predecessors in books like Journey to the West, The Water Margins, and then more recent wuxia, starting with Legend of the Condor Heroes, that kind of thing.
What is wuxia versus...
My knowledge is still in process, and so some of that is maybe a little bit more decorative and deep influence, but gotcha. But that's in mix too.
Gotcha. Okay. And so yeah, you mentioned, so is wuxia, is that Chinese then? Is that a Chinese form of storytelling?
It's a Chinese branch of, usually it's written as historical fiction, and it's written about wandering martial artists kind of on the margins of traditional Chinese culture. Often it follows these martial artists as they strive to master certain secret techniques and secret skills to become better at their martial arts, although not always. In a lot of, at least kind of the early wuxia, they tend to be very expansive stories with lots of characters and rival factions and generational conflicts. And that kind of thing is, like I said, there in the background of Jiao Tu's endeavor. Mm-hmm. But my own personal writing style, I tend to focus on a limited cast of characters. Mm-hmm. A little bit more intensely, like with the exception of one of the bonus stories, pretty much everything you're going to see in Jiao Tu's Endeavor episode one is going to be from Jiao Tu's point of view. Mm-hmm. And that was just an intentional narrative choice for the sort of stories I like to write. Yeah. And the sort of stories I think I write okay at any rate.
And then, so it's wuxia, right? It's how you pronounce, I think I pronounced it wrong. So you have that.
I've usually seen it in print, so with my due deference to people who actually speak Chinese, wuxia is I'm pretty sure how it's pronounced.
Okay. And then you have that compared to like a more samurai type of story. In the introduction, I forget who wrote the introduction, but... if wuxia, you compared wuxia to a samurai template. So what would it be from like a samurai, if you're focusing on like a samurai style storytelling? Because Zhao Tu is a samurai in a way. I mean, he would
fall more into the category in Japanese history of what would be called a yojimbo or a ronin. He's a wandering swordsman. He doesn't have a allegiance to any set master.
Right.
I guess one of the differences I would see between samurai fiction and wuxia more general, is that the samurai fiction assumes at some sort of level these Japanese traditions of master-servant interrelations, these strong senses of social class, different aspects of Japanese history that kind of get pulled over into samurai fiction. There's a, if I'm remembering the Japanese term, the jidai is the Japanese word for fictional stories, but set in a more or less accurate version of some era of the Japanese past.
Okay.
Wuxia, the patterns get established in a novel that's considered one of the four Chinese classic novels called Water Margins, which there's a lot that goes on in Water Margins, but one of the things that Water Margins is about how an essentially good person who comes from a noble background gets overlooked for promotion and discriminated against by unjust officials of the empire. It's never that the emperor himself is bad, usually, but there he has these advisors and corrupt officials. Usually there's a corrupt unit class that's being criticized, and these people conspire against the main character, disgrace his good name, and so he has to flee to the margins of society, the land of mountains and lakes. Sort of rebuild his reputation, usually by performing acts of heroism due to these poor advisors to the emperor making conditions so bad in the provinces that these bands of warrior heroes wind up taking control and taking the place of the leadership that should be getting rid of the bandits and the invading armies and things like that. It's these wandering heroes that perform these functions of justice instead. And sometimes these stories have kind of their equivalent of a happily ever after, where these heroes become rehabilitated and they're instated in high positions by the emperor. Sometimes they don't have a happy ever after. Sometimes the bad guys win. But that's at least kind of a snapshot summary of maybe some of the differences between the two subgenres.
Well, yeah, I didn't know any of that, so that's very, very good to know. It's a whole whole tradition, you know, different traditions of storytelling that I'm not familiar with. So.
Sometimes you'll get in some stories there'll be Taoist magicians and other different sorts of sorceries and magic, sometimes white magic, sometimes gray magic, sometimes definitely black magic. And so sometimes people as a kind of shorthand will call wuxia fiction as a Chinese sword and sorcery.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
It's a lot more complicated than that, and there's a lot of stuff out there that's only slowly getting translated into English. A lot of people are surprised to hear, but in a lot of ways the movie Kung Fu Panda is kind of your almost a stereotypical wuxia story where someone on the outskirts of society gets taken into this martial arts brotherhood, and through his training and cultivation of virtue and self-discovery, masters a martial arts technique that he didn't even know he would be able to. And so although it's played as a comedy, there are a lot of things in Kung Fu Panda that are very, very true to that kind of Chinese storytelling too.
Well, I've seen that movie.
It's often mentioned as kind of a point of reference.
Yeah, yeah. There's one movie I watched a ton as a kid called Kung Fu Hustle. I don't remember if you've ever heard of Kung Fu Hustle. Yeah. And I think it's supposed to be kind of like over the top, almost. I don't know if it's like making fun of the genre. I don't think I'd go that far, but it's definitely a lot of it's tongue in cheek, you know. And kind of goofy, but I remember enjoying that movie as a kid. I don't know where that fits in. I think it's kind of a wuxia sort of thing too, because it's like an marginalized. The main character is kind of a marginalized guy who masters the Buddhist palm. I think it was. You know, and then he takes out the main bad guy with that. And it's a very. I don't know if it holds up now, but as a kid, I'm like, this is awesome. You know, I watched it. Yeah. I watched it all the time.
In the 70s and early 80s, there was, at least in some places in the U.S., kind of a kung fu craze.
Yeah.
I mean, even the TV series Kung Fu with David Carradine, and I think probably Qui-Gon Chang is probably in the background somewhere in Jiao Tu's character too,
okay.
a wandering hero, although Qui-Gon Chang doesn't use swords, at least not in the most for the most part in that series, but and the Bruce Lee movies too, but mm-hmm. but there's kind of a in the 70s and 80s especially a subculture of a kung fu movies that came over in sometimes questionable dubbed versions from Hong Kong, especially. There's a studio known as the Shaw Brothers, and they did a lot of kung fu movies that would probably qualify as wuxia in the sense that I'm at least using the term.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people, one of the reviewers, one of the early reviewers of my book said that there are ways that my story read like a Shaw Brothers film written by Brian Jacques, the author of the Redwall series.
Okay, so yeah, yeah.
You imagine Redwall meets a kung fu film, sort of in the ballpark of what's going on for a good part of the story, at least in Jiao Tu's endeavor.
Yeah.
One.
Well, awesome. Maybe we'll jump into the story a bit. So, what's the basic plot of episode one?
In episode one, we meet the main character Jiao Tu, who's been hired to find a young mouse girl, a mouseling, who was kidnapped from her village and brought to a section of the world known as the Below. And he's kind of working on various tips, trying to basically see where he can see information
mm-hmm.
about what happened to this mouseling. In the course of looking for information, he very early on encounters a gang of thugs. The gang of thugs are all very nervous and agitated, and not just because there is a stranger in their territory. He finds out very quickly on this gang of thugs is nervous because there is a strange creature haunting the Below. And it looks like, in essence, kind of a bioluminescent mist. But when this mist creature attacks you, it its touch causes radiation burns on the skin, it generally kills its victims in a fairly messy way.
Yeah.
I try to, on sort of the more graphic areas, fade to black, but this is maybe one of the points of the book that sort of touches PG-13.
Right.
That this mist creature is a pretty serious deal. And so Jiao Tu escapes his encounter with the gang and this first encounter with the mist creature, and has barely had time to catch his breath when he falls in through a hole in the floor and encounters one of the serpent kin, which most of the inhabitants, the sentient inhabitants of Jiao Tu's world, are mammal-based creatures, but they have stories of what are called the serpent kin, which are anthropomorphic snakes, who are there kind of behind the scenes. And this serpent kin tells Jiao Tu that he really needs to find the mouseling because the people that have her are going to do something terrible to her, and he needs to hurry up and stop it from happening, and suggest that there may be one or two of the engineering factions that have her, either the factions known as systems or the factions known as reclamations. And so he sends Jiaotu on his way with this greater sense of urgency. And basically, as the story goes on, he gets drawn in deeper and deeper into sort of the politics of what's going down in the below among these engineering decks, and realizes that what he thought were two separate concerns, the kidnapping of this Mouseling girl and the appearance of this bloodthirsty mist monster, they aren't really two separate things, but they're intimately connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much more I can summarize without heading very strongly into spoiler territory. But...
Right. Well, we have Jiaotu, and he has this sword that he carries around with him. Is there anything unique about this sword? And I guess the answer would be yes, but just kind of tell us about the sword and who he carries around.
Jiaotu carries a name sword. The name of the sword is Black Fang. Black Fang is constructed so it looks more or less like a traditional Chinese double-edged sword, a Qian sword. But it's not constructed out of any metal that any of the creatures current in Jiaotu's world know. Instead of steel or iron or bronze, the metal appears to be a solid black with blue lightning that kind of flickers in it. And as long as he's owned the sword, Jiaotu has felt a very strong connection to the sword, has felt its presence in his mind. But as the story goes on, he finds his connection to the sword is growing stronger and stronger, to the point that he feels that the sword is talking to him in his mind. Although he is honest enough with himself to admit that he's never entirely sure whether the sword is actually talking to him or whether he's going nuts. But the sword, at least as the story progresses, seems to be at least semi-sentient, to the point where it's almost its own character. Mm-hmm. And that's actually meant to be one of the ongoing mysteries of the series. What exactly is this sword?
Right.
And if I'm allowed to finish the series, that is a mystery that will be answered what it is. But people will have to keep reading to get to the point where that question is going to be more definitively answered.
Right. Yeah, there's a few questions, at the end. That obviously were not answered because you're probably going to explore them in greater detail in future stories. For example, the religious landscape on the world ship, the Endeavor. You mention the builders, there's Mama Nuli, and then the Serpent Kin are kind of tied up with them somehow, And so I don't know if you want to, you can touch on that stuff, you know, and if you're going to, if you want, you don't have to answer in too much detail if it's going to be addressed later, you know. So go ahead, whatever you want to say.
When the people who constructed the colony ship decided that they were going to have Beastkin as crewmates, instead of having humans as crewmates, they decided, sort of as a matter of social engineering, that they needed a way to ensure that these animal people were going to be faithful to their mission, kind of generation after generation. And so what the builders of the colony ship decided was that they were going to make a religion for the animal folk to follow, where basically the human beings are meant to be revered as gods. And so the builders, which I generally refer to them with a capital B, or the makers, sometimes they're called, they're the human beings that constructed the ship. And so to kind of keep the Beastkin moving forward, keeping the agricultural systems in the big part of the ship working, keeping things moving, this religious devotion was fostered, and there's most people on the ship, most of the animal people on the ship have at least some devotion to the builders, at least as kind of abstract creators of the world they live in. There's a more fanatical group that actually have an organized religion, and that's referred to sometimes as the cult of the builders. There's a few other names I think I have for it in the stories. It's largely led by canine beast people they're kind of the fanatics of this belief in the builders. And like a lot of fanatics, especially in Sword and Planet stories, a good portion of the cult of the builders have kind of wrested control of this belief system in the builders for their own purposes, for their own ends. Although not a lot of that finds play in the first volume. Kind of as the story goes on, we find out a little bit more about the cult of the builders and what role they're trying to play in the society at large of Jiaotu's day. Mama Nuli is usually presented as the first of the gods, the first of the builders, the high goddess of among all the builders. I love languages, and playing with languages, even the name of the main character involves a play on language there. But Mama Nuli is sort of a very, very subtle one, that if you, the name of the ship itself is the Endeavor. I always spell it ending VOUR because it's named after Captain Cook's exploration ship, the HMS Endeavour. So that's why in the name of the story, it always has the British spelling. But if you translate the name of the HMS Endeavour into Chinese characters and then pronounce the characters for Endeavour, according to more or less standard Mandarin pronunciation, the word would be Nuli. So Mama Nuli is kind of a personification of the world itself. Only most of the beast people in the world don't know this. I mean, they just kind of picture her as the head of the gods, the first among all of the other builders.
Interesting.
And so the most of the beast kin have this religious system in place to kind of keep them on mission. But the human beings that constructed the ship weren't entirely sure that merely this religious duty would be enough. And so they also created the Serpent Kin. Now, this is kind of deep background of the story. Not a lot of this comes out in the text of anything I've written so far, especially not Volume One. But the Serpent Kin are unlike any of the other beast kin. Most of the beast kin have human sort of lifespans, or maybe even a little shorter, living 50, 60, 70, 80 years. The serpent kin have something different about their biology, that they're, barring accident, functionally immortal. And the idea the builders had, the human creators of the ship, was that the serpent kin were meant to be humanity's kind of eyes on the scene, and if they saw things not going right on the ship, the serpent kin would be able to intervene more or less directly without having to wake up the human crew to do it.
Okay, interesting.
In a certain sense, the serpent kin represent a separate power structure from the normal beast kin and from the builders themselves. I guess if you're familiar with Chinese mythology, they maybe function a little bit like the Taoist immortals in Chinese mythology, sort of. But that's not an exact parallel. You find out fairly early on in the second story arc that the Serpent Kin themselves started to disagree with how the ship should be run. And so there are actually factions and kind of territories among the Serpent Kin themselves. But that's something that plays out more in future episode,
Gotcha.
in the first one.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's very interesting. So you mentioned that you enjoy language and names, and I'm not a language person, but I do like names, and I like when names in stories mean things. So you mentioned Zhao Tu is kind of a play on words. So what's the play on words with the main character's name? If you don't mind me asking.
No, that's a great question. What I'll often do with characters in my stories is I will just Google like in this case, I'll Google whatever species the beast kin is, and those chances are that one of the languages spoken in the People's Republic of China, uses this word for pig. Well, if I have a character named Pig, I'm going to call him by the word for pig in Cantonese, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, it makes things sound exotic, but also makes name creation a little bit easier for me. I wanted to do something a little bit different for the main character, and there are a lot of legends surrounding rabbits in Chinese culture, many of which that get carried over into Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Western Europeans usually talk about seeing a man in the moon. Well, in China, it's actually a rabbit in the moon.
Hmm.
He's making sweet rice cakes. And
sounds good.
He's sometimes called the Jade Rabbit. And so in kind of researching possible names for my main character, I was thinking of calling him Jade Rabbit, or the Chinese equivalent of that, because, okay, well, the moon's in space, my rabbit's going to be in space, so we'll name him after the rabbit in the moon.
Yeah.
But there's also in the Chinese language, there's a whole catalog of idioms and cliches and proverbs that, when they're expressed in written Chinese, you write these proverbs using four Chinese characters. And I happen to be looking up Chinese proverbs that include include rabbits in them one day on a Google search, and came up with the four character ideogram, or the four character proverb, Jiao Chu San Ku, which roughly translated, and I hope people who speak Chinese will forgive me for not getting the tones on the Mandarin right, but Jiao Chu San Ku means a clever rabbit has three burrows.
Hmm.
The idea being, if you're smart, you're always going to have a plan C and D. You're always going to have a way out.
Right.
And once I came across this, I was kind of charmed by this Chinese idiom. And so Jiao Chu, clever rabbit, became the name of my character.
Oh, funny. Yeah. Go ahead.
At the book itself, on the back, if you have a physical copy, the two characters that make up the name Jiao Chu has kind of become an emblem for the series.
Huh?
Sort of like a Chinese signature seal will have one, two, sometimes three or four characters in a circle stamped on an official document. That's kind of the mark of the Jiao Chu series, is the two characters that make up his name in a seal circle, Jiao Chu.
Hmm. Are rabbits, are they significant in Chinese culture, where they would have a lot of idioms and proverbs about them? And they have a rabbit in the moon?
Only came up with about three or four examples.
Hmm.
And besides the Jiao Chu San Ku, usually the other cultural allusions were somewhere or another connected to the rabbit in the moon.
Interesting. Okay.
I know Japanese poetry, there's a haiku, I forget if it's a haiku or a tonka, about a rabbit swimming in a lake, but it's meant to call to mind the rabbit and the moon being reflected on the waters of the lake.
Wow, that's fascinating. Like, why is it a rabbit in the moon? That's what I, you know, because we have the man in the moon, and there's a lot of like medieval legends about that. But
If you look at it, I see two ears sometimes.
Yeah, is it just the appearance of it? That's what kind of prompted it.
I've always taken it to be the appearance.
Okay, interesting. I remember there's a Manly Wade Wellman short story with Judge Pursuivant. Where he, like, there's this Native American legend about these rabbits, and you have to be courteous to the rabbits. If you see a rabbit, you need to greet them like a person, and then they'll leave you alone. But if you don't, if you're rude to them, they'll basically drag you off and kill you.
That very easily could be stemming from authentic Native American folklore. The Southwestern culture, the trickster figure in the Southwest is Coyote. But in the Midwest, where I'm originally from, the trickster figure is a rabbit.
Interesting.
Like among the...
Well, it's Bugs Bunny, too. You know, Bugs Bunny's a trickster figure.
People. Yep, you know, Bugs Bunny, yep. You have Br'er Rabbit from the stories.
Fascinating. So, I did not know that. Yeah, that's really interesting. Rabbits, because they're skittish and they're kind of, I don't know if there's a mystery about them, but they're quick and they can duck behind something really fast. They get away from predators fast. So there's
certain cleverness about
them. I remember last summer before we moved from our old house, I had this garden, you know, I had it for about 3 years, and this is the third year I had done it. And everything was great. All of the vegetables were coming up. It was all looking really good, best year ever, you know. And then we got home from our in-laws' house, and we were coming up the stairs to where the garden is, and there everything's gone, you know. And there was a rabbit in there eating everything currently, you know, while we were there. And I would have grabbed a shovel. I wanted to grab the shovel and, you know, whack it over the head, but the kids were there, and I don't think I had the guts to do it anyway. But I really didn't want to traumatize the children by killing a rabbit. But I was ticked off of that thing. You know, I'm like, that's... And then I planted everything again, and then I did it again. It got in there again and ate everything. And then we moved, so... Yep. They're tricky. They sneak into places, even though I had the fence up. You know, they got in somehow and ate everything. So I could easily see why they would become a trickster figure for different cultures. They're very annoying, but it's not like... They're not dangerous, you know. They're just really annoying.
Kind of part of the fun of writing Zhao Tu is the juxtaposition that I'm writing about a rabbit who is extremely deadly with a sword.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of juxtaposition is a lot of fun.
Well, and all the other characters are constantly calling him Lagomorph, you know, and because that's the Lagomorph is a rabbit, you know, they're not rodents. They're different from rodents because rodents, their teeth are constantly growing, and rabbits, their teeth are not. So they used to be lumped in with rodents, but then because of that biological difference, they were separated into their own group. And so that's why, like, beavers and porcupines are rodents because their teeth are constantly growing. That's why beavers have to constantly chew on wood to keep their teeth from getting too big. And then rabbits don't have that issue, so they're classified differently.
Some story reasons is because most of the time people think of rabbits as these cute, fluffy things, and there's something, Zhao Tu isn't just a cute, fluffy bunny.
Right, yeah.
A warrior bunny, and so I used a little bit more technical of a word to refer to his species instead of some of the other species who are just mouselings or ratlings.
Right, and you have the ratlings, they're the ones in engineering, they're kind of the ones scurrying around. And you know, keeping they're all like in gangs and stuff, but their job is to keep the engines running, right? That's kind of their that's their job. And then you have like reclamations, and they're like, I think we mentioned before, they're the refuse collectors and the recyclers, you know, and there's a whole religious element to that as well, which plays into the plot quite a bit. The idea of, you know, rebirth, you know, taking something dead and making it alive, you know, that whole thing. So yeah, were those the two main factions in this first episode?
They're the two main factions that get focused on in the story.
Okay. Yeah.
There are other engineering factions in the ship, although they mostly just get mentioned by name. The drive faction, who are kind of the engineers proper, they keep the ship's engines functioning correctly. And then the fabricator faction, they're kind of the world's equivalent to the medieval and early modern tinkerers.
Okay.
If you want something made out of metal, if you want something with more technical finesse than most people out in the main part of the ship can construct, you would talk to the fabricators.
Okay.
But they really only get mentioned in passing in the story.
Yeah.
Because it's systems who originally back in the day were responsible for like the communication systems aboard the ship and the air purification systems, mm-hmm. that kind of thing on the ship. They're one of the few groups of people on the ship that still have some sense that this is something other than just a medieval level world culturally.
Yeah.
They have some remnants of higher technology.
Gotcha. Which is very reminiscent of Gene Wolfe. And so you have one of the basic, I think, elements of the story is change. Like, things are changing, right? So that's why the Serpentkin in the beginning was warning Zhao Tu. You know, he's already trying to find the mouse thing, but he gives him an extra warning, so you need to find her before something happens, because there's this change that's going to happen that the Serpentkin, at least that one, is worried about. So I don't know if you want to go into that a little bit. Like, what is changing, what's going to happen if the people who captured the mouseling, if they succeed in their plan, why would the Serpentkin be concerned about that?
Nearly all of the beast people on the ship aren't aware of the fact that they're on a spaceship, there are a certain amount of the beastkin that do know that it's a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And the animal people that do know it's a ship have this kind of long-term power struggle going on in regards to essentially, the struggle is over the direction of the ship. Both as a metaphor, kind of how things are going morally, and actually as a literal sense of what direction the ship is going in space.
Mm-hmm.
And the leader of the people who is responsible for kidnapping the mouseling believes that he can use the mouseling to reshape the direction of the ship, that she has, due to her genetics and a history in her past that she doesn't even know about, she has the ability to affect the direction the ship goes in. And so what he's trying to do is trying to use her to control the course of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And the dragon kin, or the serpent kin that Zhao Tu encounters, is much more of the opinion that the animal people that live in the ship as a whole, they should be the ones who control the direction that the ship goes in. And so he's trying to prevent this one particular group from wresting control of the ship as a whole to its own powers.
Yeah. Well, and Zhao Tu doesn't know that, right? He's not.
No.
He doesn't know he's on a ship, right? He doesn't know. Most of the characters don't. And so he's just kind of confused, like, why are you telling me this? I'm already going to do this. So it makes you think, like, oh, okay, well, the Serpentkin, there's obviously something that they want out of this. And they refer to her as a pilot, which now makes sense to me. that she can, in some way, control the direction of the ship based on her abilities once they're awakened. Yeah. So... So I don't know if
what's considered an oracle. The oracles at the launch of the ship were beastkin that, due to certain mechanical helps and certain aspects of their physiology, were able to communicate the will of the builders.
Mm-hmm.
And that would take place in a lot of different ways. And this is one of the things that one of the bonus stories in the printed volume was meant to deal with what these oracles did. They were involved in weather control. They were involved in communications from one part of the ship to another. And they were involved in directing the ship to its overall destination. We find out in this bonus story that one of the factions within the ship itself decided that they didn't like these oracles, in part because they couldn't control these oracles. They were kind of a source of power not under the influence of this rebel group.
Yeah.
So they decided to wipe the oracles out.
Mm-hmm.
And so close to 500 years later, there hasn't been an oracle since this effort to exterminate all of the oracles from the ship and wrest control of the ship for this particular group. There are a lot of fun things in that bonus story. If you pay attention, I've had people read the story and think that the third bonus story is only tied in a very tangential way to the main story, but if you read between the lines very carefully, you're supposed to realize that the oracle that the third story is about, the third story is called the Last Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
She's a mouseling, and she's actually the mouseling that Zhao Tu's trying to rescue. Great, 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 however many great grandmother.
Right, right. Yeah, it's very directly connected. Yeah.
A direct connection between the bonus story at the back of the work and a lot of what's going on in the main story arc.
Yeah. No, They're all really good, and they all connect to each other in very interesting ways. I liked, in particular, in this, I think it's the second story, how Jiao Tu, you know, spoilers, he does rescue the Mouseling, and, you know, brings her back to her family, and then he has to kind of navigate the cultural, political sort of landscape at her family's house with the matriarch, and, you know, it's very, very interesting, and, you know, kind of reminded me somewhat of, like, Spirited Away a little bit, just with like the witch, you know, mother or the grandmother witch, I can't remember her name, but just kind of running everything, running the whole household and stuff, and you can't defy her will, and yeah, very, very interesting. And yeah, I think we've gone through most of the questions. Do you have anything else to add to what we talked about?
I imagine that it's become apparent in this conversation that this story is on the quirky side. It draws from a lot of things. And I hope your listeners aren't put off by that idea of a story that draws from a lot of sources and tries to weave them all together into a coherent whole.
Those are the best kinds of stories.
if you give the story a chance, I think you'll find something pretty unique there. And I hope the listeners will check it out. I started mostly as a way of kind of trying to keep a regular writing practice going. I started releasing the story as a web novel. So a week where everything works, about three times a week, there'll be a new brief section of the current story arc posted on the main web novel.
Okay. And where can people find that?
That is at Jiao Tu's Endeavor, all one word, so JIAUTUSENDEAVOUR. So no apostrophe, make sure you put a U in Endeavor, .wordpress.com. Eventually, when I can afford to, I'll try to get something that's a little bit easier to type in. But if you go to jiaotusendeavor.com, you'll always be able to read the main story arc for free on your phone or on your computer. I'll occasionally, in between kind of the main story arcs, will include a bonus story here and there. And then the goal is, as more and more of the story gets written, the various story arcs will get compiled into book form. Everything, but you'll be able to understand the main story, though, reading it for free online, as a way of rewarding people for buying the ebook or the physical book. There's always an extra story and extra material in the physical form that isn't online.
Okay, awesome.
So as a way of rewarding the people that want a physical copy, you'll get extra material, but you'll always be able to read the main story for free. And there are a couple of other bonus features there. I have some various attempts to represent the characters, both in kind of the block print style of my cover, and some various other attempts to show you what Jiao Tu looks like, more or less in my imagination, and some of the other characters. There are links on the website where you can buy the ebook or the physical book. There's a page with some links to some of my other stories if people are interested in seeing what else I've written. kind of that's the main way of finding out everything Jiao Tu. If people are on Twitter, I have a Twitter account dedicated just to the Jiao Tu stories, and that is at Jiao Tu Wu Ku. So JIAOTUWUKU, Jiao Tu Wu Ku. Or they can follow my general account, Haiku Fiction DJU. That would have information about other things I'm writing. Being a Catholic Christian, I tend to post or repost a lot of Catholic links, or things I find interesting, things I find interesting from other indie writers that I follow. Mm-hmm. But those would be the three main ways of finding out more information and keeping in contact.
Yeah, and I guess one more. So you brought up your Catholicism again, and I'm a Catholic as well. With all these like Eastern influences on your work, how does your Catholic faith kind of influence your fiction? No, it's three an easy question. It's super easy, right?
Yeah. It's actually something I've been thinking a lot as I write these stories and as I go through these stories.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, I wanted to write these stories because I wanted to write a fun adventure story of the sort that I would want to read. And so I guess you could answer how well I did with just writing a story that's fun without being preachy. But there is kind of in the deep background, I mean, for Jiao Tu to be the sort of character that the church fathers would have considered a righteous pagan.
Hmm, yeah.
He's in a culture that in a lot of ways couldn't be farther from Catholicism if it tried, but he is still trying to do the best he can with the lights he's been given. And kind of the question I mean to pose as guiding Jiao Tu's action, it's essentially a moral question. It's in a world that's 500 years off course,
mm-hmm.
what is an individual being of honor supposed to do? And that's a question that Jiao Tu faces every day. In all honesty, it's a question that each of us face in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take much looking around us to feel like something's wrong with the world. The world, at some level or another, has gone off course. Well, if we're still going to act like noble human beings, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to act?
Yeah.
And I mean, on the first level, I want these Jiao Tu stories just to be fun, just to be enjoyable reads. But for people looking for something deeper, I'm hoping that the stories, by way of kind of a funhouse mirror, help us remember again to ask these deeper sort of questions. I mean, our world is as off course, if not more, than Jiao Tu's world is off course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm trying to be noble, if I'm trying to be just, if I'm trying to be good, how should I act? And I think we need, human beings are made for stories. We need stories. Stories shape our lives in all sorts of ways. And so we need characters who act in noble ways in spite of various difficulties, to maybe help remind us on occasion how we maybe should act when we find ourselves in difficult situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Zhao Tu does a decent job, you know, trying to both accomplish his mission but retain his moral code. And so it makes for the tension there makes for pretty fun reading. Because not only is there's a tension of danger, but then there's a tension of like your own honor, your own moral compass being tested by the patterns of the world, world off course, you know. So very interesting. And so, Donald, I have one more question for you. First of all, thank you for coming on my show. I'm glad we could finally make it work. I know that there's a lot of stuff conspiring against it, but we were able to make it work. So I want to ask you a question. So this show is called I Might Believe in Fairies. And, oh man, I'm sick of my voice being so so raspy. But the show is called I Might Believe in Fairies because personally I am more or less agnostic about the existence of creatures known as fairies. But I want to ask you, Donald, do you believe in fairies?
I believe that there is much more to our physical reality than we see with our eyes. I think there is too much evidence across cultures that there is something more, even to the physical world, than what we can explain with science. If we want to call that something more fairies, I would be okay with that. So I think I would say yes, I believe in fairies.
All right. Sounds good. So do you have any final thoughts? Again, thanks for coming on my show. You can have the last word if you want.
Thank you for having me. I hope that kind of the unique nature of what I'm at least trying to do in my story came across in this interview, and I hope your listeners will check it out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you are excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada. And podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.